Chapter 27. Be brought to the ordeal. We came then, and showed our little hands to the master, washed them or not most probably, I should say, not and so went bewildered back to bed. Something had been stolen in the school that day, and Mr. Wiseacre having read in a book of an ingenious method of finding out a thief, by making him put his hand into a sack which, if guilty, the rogue would shirk from doing, all we boys were subjected to the trial. Goodness knows what the lost object was, or who stole it. We all had black hands to show the master. And the thief, whoever he was not found out that time. I wonder if the rascal is alive, an elderly scoundrel he must be by this time, and a hoary old hypocrite, to whom an old schoolfellow presents his kindest regards parenthetically remarking, what a dreadful place that private school was, cold, chilblains, bad dinners, not enough victuals, and caning awful. Are you alive still, I say, you nameless villain, who escaped discovery on that day of crime? I hope you have escaped often since, old sinner. Ah, what a lucky thing it is, for you and me, my man, that we are not found out in all our peccadillos, and that our backs can slip away from the master and the cane. Just consider what life would be, if every rogue was found out, and flogged coram populo. What a butchery, what an indecency, what an endless swishing of the rod. Don't cry out about my misanthropy. My good friend Mealymouth, I will trouble you to tell me, do you go to church? When there, do you say, or do you not, that you are a miserable sinner, and saying so do you believe or disbelieve it? If you are a MS, don't you deserve correction, and aren't you grateful, if you are to be let off? I say again what a blessed thing it is that we are not all found out. Just picture to yourself everybody who does wrong being found out, and punished accordingly. Fancy all the boys in all the school being whipped, and then the assistants, and then the headmaster, Dr. Batford let us call him, fancy the provost marshal being tied up, having previously superintended the correction of the whole army. After the young gentlemen have had their turn for the faulty exercises, fancy Dr. Lincolnson being taken up for certain faults in his essay and review. After the clergyman has cried his peccavi, suppose we hoist up a bishop, and give him a couple of dozen. I see my Lord Bishop of Double Gloucester sitting in a very uneasy posture on his right reverend bench. After we have cast off the bishop, what are we to say to the minister who appointed him? My Lord Cinquarden, it is painful to have to use personal correction to a boy of your age, but really, sis tandem carnifex. The butchery is too horrible. The hand drops powerless, appalled at the quantity of birch which it must cut and brandish. I am glad we are not all found out, I say again, and protest, my dear brethren, against our having our deserts. To fancy all men found out and punished is bad enough, but imagine all the women found out in the distinguished social circle in which you and I have the honor to move. Is it not a mercy, that a many of these fair criminals remain unpunished and undiscovered? There is Mrs. Longbow, who is forever practicing, and who shoots poisoned arrows too. When you meet her, you don't call her liar, and charge her with the wickedness she has done and is doing. There is Mrs. Painter, who passes for a most respectable woman, and a model in society. There is no use in saying what you really know regarding her and her goings-on. There is Diana Hunter, what a little haughty prude it is, and yet we know stories about her which are not altogether edifying. I say it is best for the sake of the good that the bad should not all be found out. You don't want your children to know the history of that lady in the next box, who is so handsome, and whom they admire so. Ah me, what would life be if we were all found out, and punished for all our faults? Jack Ketch would be in permanence, and then who would hang Jack Ketch? They talk of murderers being pretty certainly found out. Sah! I have heard an authority awfully competent vow, and declare that scores and hundreds of murders are committed, and nobody is the wiser. That terrible man mentioned one or two ways of committing murder, which he maintained were quite common, and were scarcely ever found out. A man, for instance, comes home to his wife, and... But I pause, I know that this magazine has a very large circulation. Asterisk hundreds and hundreds of thousands, why not say a million of people at once? Well, say a million read it. And among these countless readers, I might be teaching some monster how to make away with his wife without being found out, some fiend of a woman, how to destroy her dear husband. I will not then tell this easy and simple way of murder, as communicated to me by a most respectable party in the confidence of private intercourse. Suppose some gentle reader were to try this most simple and easy receipt that seems to me almost infallible, and come to grief in consequence, and be found out and hanged? Should I ever pardon myself for having been the means of doing injury to a single one of our esteemed subscribers? The prescription whereof I speak, that is to say, whereof I don't speak, shall be buried in this bosom. No, I am a humane man. I am not one of your bluebeards, to go and say to my wife, my dear, I am going away for a few days to Brighton. Here are all the keys of the house. You may open every door and close it, except the one at the end of the oak room opposite the fireplace, with the little bronze Shakespeare on the mantelpiece, or what not. I don't say this to a woman unless, to be sure, I want to get rid of her because, after such a caution, I know she'll peep into the closet. I say nothing about the closet at all. I keep the key in my pocket, and a being whom I love, but who, as I know, has many weaknesses, out of harm's way. You toss up your head, dear angel, drub on the ground with your lovely little feet, on the table with your sweet rosy fingers, and cry, oh, sneer. You don't know the depth of woman's feeling, the lofty scorn of all deceit, the entire absence of mean curiosity in the sex, or never, never would you libel us so. Ah, Delia. Dear, dear Delia. It is because I fancy I do know something about you, not all, mind, no, no, no man knows that. Ah, my bride, my ring dove, my rose, my papa choose, in fact, whatever name you like, bulb of my grove, fountain of my desert, sunshine of my darkling life, and joy of my dungeoned existence, it is because I do know a little about you, that I conclude to say nothing of that private closet, and keep my key in my pocket. You take away that closet key then, and the house key. You lock Delia in. You keep her out of harm's way and gadding, and so she never can be found out. Asterisk the Cornhill. Editor. And yet by little strange accidents and coincidence, how we are being found out every day. You remember that old story of the Abcacados, who told the company at supper one night, how the first confession he ever received, was from a murderer, let us say. Presently enters to supper the Marquis de Croquemiton. Palsambleu, Ab, says the brilliant Marquis, taking a pinch of snuff, are you here? Gentlemen and ladies, I was the Ab's first penitent, and I made him a confession, which I promise you astonished him. To be sure how queerly things are found out. Here is an instance. Only the other day I was writing in these roundabout papers about a certain man, whom I facetiously called Bax, and who had abused me to my friends, who of course told me. Shortly after that paper was published, another friend Sax, let us call him, scowls fiercely at me as I am sitting in perfect good humor at the club, and passes on without speaking. A cut. A quarrel. Sax thinks it is about him that I was writing. Whereas, upon my honor and conscience, I never had him once in my mind, and was pointing my moral from quite another man. But don't you see, by this wrath of the guilty conscience, Sax, that he had been abusing me too? He has owned himself guilty, never having been accused. He has winced when nobody thought of hitting him. I did but put the cap out, and madly butting and chafing, behold, my friend rushes out to put his head into it. Never mind, Sax, you are found out, but I bear you no malice, my man. And yet to be found out, I know from my own experience, must be painful and odious, and cruelly mortifying to the inward vanity. Suppose I am a poltroon, let us say, with fierce mustache, loud talk, plentiful oaths, and an immense stick, I keep up nevertheless a character for courage. I swear fearfully at cabmen and women, brandish my bludgeon, and perhaps knock down a little man or two with it. Brag of the images which I break at the shooting gallery, and pass among my friends for a whiskery fire-eater, afraid of neither man nor dragon. Ah me! Suppose some brisk little chap steps up, and gives me a caning in St. James Street, with all the heads of my friends looking out of all the club windows. My reputation is gone. I frighten no man more. My nose is pulled by whippersnappers, who jump up on a chair to reach it. I am found out. And in the days of my triumphs, when people were yet afraid of me, and were taken in by my swagger, I always knew that I was a lily liver, and expected that I should be found out someday. That certainty of being found out must haunt and depress many a bold braggadocious spirit. Let us say it is a clergyman, who can pump copious floods of tears out of his own eyes and those of his audience. He thinks to himself, I am but a poor swindling, chattering rogue. My bills are unpaid. I have jilted several women whom I have promised to marry. I don't know whether I believe what I preach, and I know I have stolen the very sermon over which I have been sniveling. Have they found me out? Says he, as his head drops down on the cushion. Then your writer, poet, historian, novelist, or what not. The Beacon says that Joan's work is one of the first order. The Lamp declares that Joan's tragedy surpasses every work since the days of Him of Avon. The Comet asserts that Jay's Life of Goody Two Shoes is a Greek text omitted, a noble and enduring monument to the fame of that admirable Englishwoman, and so forth. But then Jones knows that he has lent the critic of the Beacon £5, that his publisher has a half share in the Lamp, and that the cornet comes repeatedly to dine with him. It is all very well. Jones is immortal until he is found out, and then down comes the extinguisher, and the immortal is dead and buried. The idea, dies eerie, of discovery must haunt many a man, and make him uneasy, as the trumpets are puffing in his triumph. Brown, who has a higher place than he deserves, cowers before Smith, who has found him out. What is the chorus of critics shouting, bravo? A public clapping hands and flinging garlands? Brown knows that Smith has found him out. Puff, trumpets, wave, banners, huzzah, boys, for the immortal Brown. This is all very well, methinks, bowing the while, smiling, laying his hand to his heart, but there stands Smith at the window. He has measured me, and someday the others will find me out too. It is a very curious sensation to sit by a man who has found you out, and who, as you know, has found you out, or, vice versa, to sit with a man whom you have found out. His talent? Bah! His virtue? We know a little story or two about his virtue, and he knows we know it. We are thinking over friend Robinson's antecedents, as we grin, bow and talk, and we are both humbugs together. Robinson a good fellow, is he? You know how he behaved to Hicks? A good-natured man, is he? Pray do you remember that little story of Mrs. Robinson's black eye? How men have to work, to talk, to smile, to go to bed, and try and sleep, with this dread of being found out on their consciences. Bartolf, who has robbed a church, and Nim, who has taken a purse, go to their usual haunts, and smoke their pipes with their companions. Mr. Detective Bullseye appears, and says, oh, Bartolf, I want you about that there picks business. Mr. Bartolf knocks the ashes out of his pipe, puts out his hands to the little steel cuffs, and walks away quite meekly. He is found out. He must go. Goodbye, dull tear sheet. Goodbye, Mrs. Quickly, ma'am. The other gentlemen and ladies de l'associate look on, and exchange mute adieu with the departing friends. And an assured time will come when the other gentlemen and ladies will be found out too. What a wonderful and beautiful provision of nature it has been that, for the most part, our womankind are not endowed with the faculty of finding us out. They don't doubt, and probe, and weigh, and take your measure. Lay down this paper, my benevolent friend and reader, go into your drawing room now, and utter a joke ever so old, and I wager sixpence the ladies there will all begin to laugh. Go to Brown's house, and tell Mrs. Brown and the young ladies, what you think of him, and see what a welcome you will get. In like manner, let him come to your house, and tell your good lady his candid opinion of you, and fancy how she will receive him. Would you have your wife and children know you exactly for what you are, and esteem you precisely at your worth? If so, my friend, you will live in a dreary house, and you will have but a chilly fireside. Do you suppose the people round it don't see your homely face, as under a glamour, and, as it were, with a halo of love round it? You don't fancy you are as you seem to them? No such thing, my man. Put away that monstrous conceit, and be thankful that they have not found you out. The Nutch on the Axe, a story a la mode asterisk, asterisk, here Thackeray reduces to an absurdity the literary fashion of the day evoked for startling stories and tales of terror, which was high in his time, and which influenced several of the stories which proceed in this volume. But while Dickens made fun, with mental reservations, while Bulwer-Lytton tried to explain, by rising to the heights of natural philosophy, and Maturin did not explain at all, but let his extravagant genius roam between heaven and earth, Thackeray's keen wit saw mainly one chance for exquisite literary satire and parody. At one point or another in this skit, the style of each principal sensational novelist of the day is delightfully imitated. Editor. Everyone remembers in the fourth book of the immortal poem of your blind bard, to whose sightless orbs no doubt glorious shapes were apparent, and visions celestial, how Adam discourses to Eve of the bright visitors who hovered round their Eden, millions of spiritual creatures walk the earth, unseen, both when we wake, and when we sleep. Apostrophe, how often, apostrophe says Father Adam, apostrophe from the steep of echoing hill or thicket, have we heard celestial voices to the midnight air, soul, or responsive to each other's notes, singing. Apostrophe, apostrophe after the act of disobedience, when the erring pair from Eden, took their solitary way, and went forth to toil, and trouble on common earth, though the glorious ones no longer were visible, you cannot say they were gone. It was not that the bright ones were absent, but that the dim eyes of rebel man no longer could see them. In your chamber, hangs a picture of one whom you never knew, but whom you have long held in tenderest regard, and who was painted for you by a friend of mine, the Knight of Plympton. She communes with you. She smiles on you. When your spirits are low, her bright eyes shine on you and cheer you. Her innocent sweet smile is a caress to you. She never fails to soothe you with her speechless prattle. You love her. She is alive with you. As you extinguish your candle and turn to sleep, though your eyes see her not, is she not there still smiling? As you lie in the night awake, and thinking of your duties, and the morrow's inevitable toil oppressing the busy, weary, wakeful brain as with a remorse, the crackling fire flashes up for a moment in the grate, and she is there, your little bodious maiden, smiling with her sweet eyes. When moon is down, when fire is out, when curtains are drawn, when lids are closed, is she not there, the little beautiful one, though invisible, present and smiling still? Friend, the unseen ones are round about us. Does it not seem as if the time were drawing near when it shall be given to men to behold them? The print of which my friend spoke, and which, indeed, hangs in my room, though he has never been there, is that charming little winter piece of Sir Joshua, representing the little Lady Caroline Montagu, afterwards Duchess of Buccleuch. She is represented as standing in the midst of a winter landscape, wrapped in muff and cloak, and she looks out of her picture with a smile, so exquisite. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.